This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie, where I go deep with the artists, entrepreneurs, and visionaries who are making the world a more libertarian, or at least a more interesting place, by championing free minds and free markets. Before we start today's episode, I want to urge you to donate to Reason's annual Webathon. This is the one time a year when we ask our online audience to support our principled libertarian journalism with tax-deductible donations. Click on the link in the show notes or go to reason.com/donate. Your support is absolutely vital to our efforts, and Lord knows we've got our work cut out for us in the coming year. My guest today is the brilliant science writer Matt Ridley. He exemplifies what this podcast and Reason are all about. He's author of best-selling books such as The Red Queen, The Rational Optimist, and Viral, The Search for the Origins of COVID-19. In a live event filmed in New York City, Matt and I discuss how science, our best tool for understanding and improving the world, has turned into a centralized, hyper-politicized priesthood even before COVID. Matt walks through the collapse of public trust as experts flipped on mass and transmission during the pandemic, declared BLM protests safe but religious services dangerous, and insisted on certainty where none existed. He explains how the lab leak hypothesis went from forbidden conspiracy to the most plausible explanation. We also get into the fight over climate alarmism, the future of innovation in an age of overregulation, and why he's bullish on nuclear and AI. Matt also makes the case for how America can spark a new technological renaissance, even as political and scientific elites seem determined to smother dissent. Here is The Reason Interview with Matt Ridley. So, Matt Ridley, Lord Ridley, I want to start bringing up something that Bill Gates said recently, where he said, we need to make improving human welfare the top priority of our energy and climate efforts. And this was, he took a lot of people aback because he was saying that climate change is important, the environment is important, but it's actually more important that we make life better for the people who are here and now. How did you feel about when Bill Gates seemed to be shifting his priorities somewhat in a direction that you have been talking about for literally decades now?
Well, there was a temptation to say thank you at last, Bill, for saying what we've been saying. And you know, Bill and I had an exchange about this in the pages of the Wall Street Journal in 2011. He had recommended my book, but said it was all wrong on climate change. The book was The Rational Optimist. And I wrote to him and said, how do you fancy a written exchange of essays in the Wall Street Journal? And to my amazement, he agreed, and we had a good exchange of views. But in that exchange, I said, there are much more important issues, like the welfare of a billion people on the planet who haven't got electricity, etc. And yes, climate change, it matters, but no, it's not an existential threat to mankind. And we disagreed about that. So I guess 14 years later, I've won the argument.
So does it, you know, or can we read anything bigger into this? We're coming out of a period of, you know, during the COVID period where we saw science get extremely politicized and also incredibly centralized, certainly in the United States. We'll talk a bit about your book with Alina Chan about the lab leak theory in a bit. But, you know, is science getting better now? Or are people treating it more as a process rather than a kind of political hobby horse?
Well, just back to Gates and climate for a second. I think there is a definite attempt to negotiate a way off the high horse that people got on about climate. And he's not the only one. And he's a harbinger of a sea change there. Now, some people are doing that because they want to panic the world about AI instead. Yeah. I think they're probably just as wrong. I mean, I think there are problems with AI, but I very much doubt it's an existential threat for reasons we might be able to get into. And other people are doing it because they, well, you know, it's had a good run, 40, 50 years. The climate's warmed, but there's been no significant increase in drought, storms, or floods, particularly in terms of human welfare and human deaths and things like that. And so they've got to find a way to get off that high horse.
Oh, really? Because the threat isn't scary enough anymore.
I think so. You know, I mean, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, just in time for this new meeting in Brazil, has brought the estimated temperature rise in business as usual down below 3 degrees for the end of the century for the first time. And it was above 4 15 years ago. but they say, but the really dangerous stuff cuts in at a much lower level than we thought. So right. That's a sort of, you know, that's a negotiation there. The point I was going to make was that I think climate's a bit of an exception here. I think there is the beginning of a negotiation with common sense happening in climate. But I don't see that happening in science generally. I am dismayed by how, particularly during the pandemic, science got itself in a right mess, predicting and asserting things that were wrong and losing the trust of the public big time, to the point where, you know, people's vaccination rates are dropping pretty steeply and nobody quite knows what to believe because they don't trust the experts anymore.
Yeah, so
they're not examining their own role in causing that.
So when we're talking about science here with a capital S, we're talking about individuals, but also the institutions that kind of promote or perform science. But talk, you know, during COVID, what were the things, the biggest mistakes that were made that shook the public's trust in and confidence in science?
Well, January 2020, they said no evidence of human-to-human transmission, the World Health Organization. Well, that was wrong. Then they said it's not airborne. They put the "not" in capital letters in their tweet, the World Health Organization. Wrong. Then they said, the vaccines would stop transmission. That was wrong. They said masks would work, masks wouldn't work, masks mm-hmm. would work, masks wouldn't work. You know, they kept flip-flopping on that. And I think one of the ones that lost the public's support in most was when they said, you cannot visit your grandmother in hospital because it's dangerous, but you can go on a Black Lives Matter protest with 10,000 people because that's not dangerous. 1,200 experts right. signed a letter, an open letter saying that. And I think the vast majority of people thought, hang on a minute, are you really arguing that from logic, or are you being ideological here?
To push back on that a little bit, the public health people would say public health is always a series of costs and benefits, and that, you know, you going to see your grandmother dying, there's not a lot of public benefit to that. And, you know, you might give her COVID and, you know, that would be bad because it would interfere with her dying. But that going to a Black Lives Matter march or a political march, that might shift policy in a way that, well, you know, the benefits of that would outweigh the costs in terms of spreading some amount of COVID. Is that just bullshit?
Well, I just think that the public health profession needs to learn some humility, some accountability, some transparency, because, you know, the reliance on models was outrageous. And I personally think that anyone who uses models about the future to tell us what to do, whether it's in an epidemic, an economy, or a climate, is probably a snake oil salesman.
What's the alternative? How do you model the future if not with models?
You don't. There's a very good book by a former governor of the Bank of England, Mervyn King, and John Kay, who's an academic, called Radical Uncertainty, which says a lot of the problem that we got into over the financial crisis was because people thought they could put a number on risks that you can't put a number on. Mm. Some risks you can put a number on, others you can't. Yeah. And we need to be much more honest about which ones you can't. I think that's a really important point. There's nothing wrong with a model of how, you know, a synapse works in between two cells, but a model of the future is in a complex dynamic system. I mean, you could model whether the sun's going to rise in the east tomorrow. Fine, right. You know, good luck to you with that. You're probably going to be right. But a model of a complex dynamic system into the future is trying to place certainty where it just can't be placed.
Just to,
I think that there is no expert on the future.
The model that really put a scare into Britain and North America was coming out of Imperial College, and it turned out that was being run on like an old, IBM XT, with DOS 1.0 or something like that. Can you talk a little bit about how it's not just modeling, but it's the quality of modeling that gets done? Or is it that, we just get the conclusion and then we're told to kind of shut up and go along because the experts have spoken? So don't look at how you get to the answer.
Yeah, well, I actually was able to confront Professor Neil Ferguson, who was the person who did those models, individually, when I was on the Science and Technology Select Committee in the House of Lords. And I said, look, your model has been used to predict a ridiculous number for Sweden, which turned out to be wrong. And he said, our model wasn't used in Sweden. And I said, no, I didn't say you used it. Mm-hmm. Somebody else did. And here's the evidence. And we got into a ding-dong about that. So I do think that...
A ding-dong at the House of Lords. That sounds very British.
What's wrong with the phrase ding-dong? I quite like ding-dong.
It's a snack cake. A very good one.
But later in the pandemic, in the UK, there was a very significant moment because it was the end of 21, December 21, the Omicron variant was on the march. Cases were rising. And the scientific advisory group for epidemics, which advised the UK government, said, unless you lock down again, cases are going to go up to between 600 and 6,000 deaths per day by the middle of January. Now, A, that's a weirdly wide range. That doesn't really tell you anything. And B, for once, Boris Johnson's government called their bluff and said, we're not going to lock down. Do you know how high those deaths actually peaked in January? 200 deaths a day, well below the bottom of their range. Now, there's been no sort of inquisition about this, right? That you said it would never go below 600 a day, and in fact it went below 200. The assumption they were getting wrong was the virulence of Omicron, which was by then well known to be very low, but they didn't want to admit it because they thought that might not scare people.
Yeah, why did they want to scare people? I mean, is it just when you're in power, you just want to maintain control, or was it, is it conscious and intentional, or is it just the dynamic that takes over people?
I think the pandemic is a really important moment in the history of science because the scientific, I mean, there's absolutely nothing wrong with science as a philosophy. Right. It's humanity's greatest achievement bar none. It's the fantastic way of finding out about the universe.
And that's the idea of falsifying hypotheses and getting data and research.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a point. But science as an institution has become more and more like the Catholic Church.
Here comes the British guy, right? No.
It wants to kick out heretics and it wants to enforce dogma. And it becomes more and more insistent on what it calls consensus, which is another word for groupthink. In lots of areas, including climate, including the pandemic, you saw this. And it is rebounding on public trust in science. Now, where is the evidence that the academic community is going back and examining its own role in causing this problem?
And that's what they should be doing, right? Yeah. If they're serious scientists, they should be going back through, the recent past and saying like, oh, this is how I came to the wrong
conclusion. And I haven't touched on the origin of the virus.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit about that because you mentioned the World Health Organization in passing. Is part of the problem that science or scientific institutions have become more and more centralized, where a few major players can dictate, a wide swath of what is considered true at any given moment?
Yes, it is. The problem here is confirmation bias, which is the mother of all biases, and it's one we all suffer from, and we treat our own theories as like a lawyer prosecuting a case, we want the guy to be guilty, and we're going to look for every bit of evidence that suggests he's guilty, and we're not going to look for disconfirmatory evidence. So you and you can't expect scientists to be different, and I'm not asking them to be. But what I am asking is that Professor A is free to tell Professor B that he's talking bull. Am I allowed to use the word bullshit?
No, you're not.
Okay.
So we're in quite a conundrum. Yes, you could. Cursing is totally permissible, not obligatory.
Bovine audio.
Yeah.
So that was what kept science honest. If you examine why it was so immensely successful in the 20th century, it was because it was very decentralized, actually. Mm-hmm. It was put in universities all over the place. So, you know, the first thing Professor A wants to do when he wakes up in the morning is pull Professor B down a peg.
Yeah.
You know, that's sort of the way it works. The NIH and the NIAID in particular, the thing that the body that Anthony Fauci was in mm-hmm. charge of, was giving out many billions of dollars through one pipe. And he was making it very clear what his view was. And if you didn't adhere to that view, you didn't stand such a chance of getting funded. And, you know, in the UK, we had the government, but we also had the Wellcome Trust. So that's mm-hmm. nice. They compete. No, they don't. They just ended up putting the same people on the same committees and doing the same thing. So it's the monopolization, centralization of funding that is, I think, at the heart of this problem.
What is a structural reform, or what's the best structural reform to kind of minimize that kind of centralization?
It's got to take the form of fragmentation of funding. And red team, blue team, you know, it's not impossible for the new head of the NIH, Jay Bhattacharya, who after all was himself subject to significant abuse and cancellation for saying lockdowns were not the right way to go. It's not impossible for him to say, we are going to fund Professor A to criticize Professor B on all sorts of issues, on Alzheimer's, on lots of other issues where a monolithic view has kept out maverick theories. Because nearly all scientific insights start out as maverick heresies. That doesn't mean all maverick heresies are right, of course, quite the reverse. But it does mean that you have to allow some degree of dissent and challenge.
Well, and
in
you
the
have
system.
To fund it ultimately, right?
And
by
you,
I mean society has to.
Yeah.
Do you have any sense? Let's talk about vaccines a little bit, because you mentioned that vaccine rates are going down. Vaccines have been one of the greatest inventions, right, in human history.
Correct. I mean,
they're largely responsible for the increase in life expectancy over the past 100 years or so. Where do people who have become skeptical of vaccines, where are they wrong, and how does science or public health officials, how do they gain back the trust in that knowledge that vaccination is generally good?
I wish I knew, because I'm struggling with this myself. I still think vaccines are a fantastic technology and one that has saved billions of lives. Maybe sanitation has saved more, but they are an extraordinary invention, and we invented them long before we understood how they worked. But how do I know that Bobby Kennedy is talking through his hat on when he says
that? I think it's when he's moving his lips.
Well,
we're talking about Sirhan Sirhan. But yeah, how do you know? You would know better than me.
You know, even I, as a fanatical supporter of vaccines, have started to say, well, you know, let's have a look at whether or not these adjuvants are actually as safe as they say they are, et cetera, et cetera. And part of the problem there, I think, has been the sort of free pass that vaccines get in terms of any harm they do not being, there's no comeback on the vaccine makers. I think the approach that the scientific establishment wants to take, which is hammer home in as bossy a way as possible that vaccines are good for you, isn't the right way to go. The right way to go is to open the books, show the data, say, look, Bobby's talking through his hat.
Right.
This is not the case.
But there are adverse effects to vaccines, including COVID vaccines.
Yeah, and I remember advising a British government minister who was talking to us in the middle of the pandemic when the vaccines were just appearing. I said, please, please, please don't say they have no side effects because that will come back to bite you.
Yeah.
Oh, well, if we did that, then we might. No, you know,
there's a real disinterest in treating, you know, citizens as adults, it seems.
That's the heart of the problem.
Yeah.
There is a very top-down view of people. And I think, you know, quite rightly, people want to be involved in the conversation and have their own view.
With vaccines, is there, you know, what distinctions do you make between compulsory vaccines and voluntary uptake of vaccines?
Yeah. Well, I personally would rather pretty well all vaccines were voluntary, but you put as much push behind the ones that need to reach us. You know, the problem is some of them need to reach 95% level to get herd immunity or whatever it is. Measles, for example, you get outbreaks if it drops below, I think it's 95%, something like that. I think that the sort of 1950s view that you could impose these things by force has to be wrong. There must be possible to do this by persuasion.
Let's talk about bird sex and beauty. Can you summarize your thesis in bird sex and beauty?
Yeah, this was a book that came out earlier this year. It's got pictures of beautiful birds in it by me. It's got
By birds, we mean things that fly, not the British slang for good-looking women, right?
Well, if potential readers are confused about that, that's fine by me. They'll be disappointed when they buy the book. But I have always wanted to go back to the topic which I wrote a PhD thesis on many, many years ago, which is sexual selection, because I think it's got more interesting again recently. And there is this...
Is that because of dating apps?
It's not about humans, this book. It's about birds. Sorry, Nick. But there is one chapter on humans. So the question is why this extravagant, beautiful plumage that you find on a lot of male birds in particular, some female, but mostly male birds, and extravagant, beautiful songs. And Darwin had this weird idea that it was because the females had an aesthetic sense and were interested in beautiful males. And they wanted to mate with them and not with the dull males. And everyone said, A, that's nonsense because beautiful males were put there to please human beings by God. And B, it's nonsense because birds are not clever enough to appreciate aesthetic pleasure. They didn't go to Oxford University. and C, they're not clever enough and so on, you know.
Yeah.
So he lost that argument in his lifetime. And his problem was always, well, if a peahen prefers a male with a flashy tail, why? What's in it for her? And a brilliant answer was developed in 1930 by Ronald Fisher, the great mathematician and evolutionary biologist, which I think has stood the test of time and is now finally winning the argument. And that is that the female wants a brightly coloured male, not because the bright colours indicate that he's healthy and therefore his babies will be healthy. It might be that. Mm-hmm. But more important, it indicates that he's sexy and the babies might be sexy. So in other words, it's called the sexy son hypothesis. And the other words, the female is really worried that if she doesn't follow the fashion for large-tailed males, she'll end up with small-tailed sons who won't get laid. and so she has to completely go with it, and that means that you get a runaway arms race between the trait and the preference, which can go in really weird directions. So this sexual selection thing is very different from natural selection. Mm. It's seduction of the hottest rather than survival of the fittest.
Does that end up, famously, I guess there's examples where it ends up with usually male versions of a species that really can't function very well. You know, gigantic antlers or a plumage that ends up making more conspicuous than survivable.
Yeah, well, I did a study of peacocks years ago, and I discovered that it's quite easy to creep up behind them when they're displaying because they can't see you coming and grab them by the legs if you want to measure and weigh them. You can only do it once per peacock. Yeah. They will never let you go behind them after that. But so that's an example. You know, they are vulnerable when they're displaying. It's an expensive thing to do. It makes them vulnerable. The particular bird that I focus on in the book, the black grouse, has this habit of the males gathering together and communally displaying. Well, that's a sort of buffet for a passing eagle. You know, so it's the females have bred this habit and these plumages into these birds and made the males exhausted and vulnerable and et cetera, et cetera.
So does
but they're putting them to the test.
Does this
and they're in charge. That's the fascinating that's the bit the Victorians couldn't accept. That the females might be in charge of
the
process.
Well, that the women were the selectors.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Translate that into, you know, human behavior. Is that in the 1950s, there were a lot of critics of post-war consumerism who said that women, women forced men to work hard to buy the newest appliance, the newest car. They had to dress a particular way, and that it put men in particular. And I'm thinking of Growing Up Absurd and a couple of other books that came out of the 50s counterculture, where it's like, oh, women are to blame for men being so miserable in a consumerist society. Is that consonant with your evolutionary theory?
I don't think so. I think that's a stretch. For a start, we are much more monogamous. We're not polygamous like these birds that I'm talking about. We're not perfectly monogamous, of course, but and there is undoubtedly sexual selection going on in humans. There are features of human beings that aren't there for survival, but are there for seduction. One of them possibly being the human brain itself. Wow. Why did it get so big so suddenly 2 million years ago? Maybe just to help us, dazzle members of the other sex. Also in human beings, like seabirds, but not like other kinds of birds, sexual selection does seem to be going both ways. Males are very choosy about the females they mate with, and females are very choosy about the males they mate with. And that would lead to them breeding features into the opposite sex that suited them. The stuff you're talking about in the 1950s, maybe one could make that argument. I haven't looked. I'll have to go and model it, I think.
Okay. Yeah. Very good. Evolutionary biology, evolutionary psychology, it seems to me, often gets used in contemporary debates, almost always for a specifically conservative agenda or to maintain the status quo. We shouldn't, things are the way they are because that's how human beings are. It rarely seems that evolution, which itself is one of the most disruptive and I hesitate to say progressive because I don't mean it in a contemporary political term, but it is something that shattered old ways of thinking. I mean, the Enlightenment gives rise to the ability to a society where evolution can become a theory that changes everything and displaces God and hierarchy and transition or institutions like that. Do you feel like evolutionary biology or evolutionary psychology gets a bad rap as something that explains why this group does better than that group, or this person does better than that person, or things are okay the way they are, because maybe it's not God ordaining it, it's biology.
It's a good point, and it does get a bad rap in all sorts of ways, and I think it's vital not to overplay it and to develop weird just-so stories about why we did something that we do, or why we did something that we did. But I don't myself feel that it's necessarily the friend of ultra-conservatism. I think there are examples where evolutionary explanations would indeed come down on the liberal side of a conversation.
And you mean that in a liberal sense of giving more power to the individual, more autonomy.
Yes, but I also mean probably more on the left wing side on this occasion. I prefer to use the word liberal in the sense that
Do you worry? I mean, I guess it's going back to the discussion of COVID. Is there under somebody like Anthony Fauci, politics trump scientific inquiry? Do you worry that under, you know, with somebody like Robert Kennedy as Health and Human Services Secretary, you know, and he's overseeing a huge amount of scientific funding, are we going in a different direction where politics or ideology dictates scientific inquiry at the highest level?
The politicization of science funding under the Trump administration is a huge concern. But I would like to say to my liberal friends in academia, was it sensible of you to politicize it on your side of the fence first?
Yeah.
Because you've handed the gift to the other side. And I think this, I call this the boomerang effect or the hoist by your own petard effect. It's an increasingly common, I think, problem and phenomenon in this world, is that people are doing things for the short-term political gain that they then find out later will boomerang back on them. And just as liberals have delivered an excuse to the Trump administration to be much more interfering in science, so the Trump administration is undoubtedly delivering excuses for the next left-wing president to be much more interfering in academia, for example. So, yes, I think that is a problem.
Do you, you know, well, we started off talking about how, you know, Bill Gates has literally come around to your position in the 2011 Wall Street Journal debate that you had with him. Lab leak is another theory of yours that has gone from, you know, a racist conspiracy or, you know, a weirdo conspiracy theory to plausible, if not obvious to many people. What changed with that? Because you are saying, you know, that academics or the scientists who should be doing it are not going back and interrogating their work and its failings. So why does it seem more people are willing to be like, oh yeah, the lab leak theory makes a certain amount of sense?
It's an extraordinary episode in the history of science. There's people in the audience like Bryce Nichols who played an incredibly important part in this as well. And I, you know, mainly was helping Alina Chan, who's
right,
an unbelievably brave young researcher. And neither of us started out thinking it was definitely a lab leak, but nor did we think it could be ruled out. And we had seen evidence, for example, that it didn't start in the market and that it was well adapted to human beings from the get-go, which implied a lab as quite a strong hypothesis. And we looked into everything we could look into, including exactly where those scientists had gone, on which days, in which months, in which caves, and collected samples from which bats, and what they had then done with those samples. And the people who made the running were a bunch of amateurs, extraordinary individuals like The Seeker, an Indian 30-year-old guy who knows how to use the internet, who got hold of some passwords to Chinese academic websites, as you do, and found out some unbelievably important information. People like Gilles Demeneuf, who's an accountant in New Zealand, a Frenchman, who got under the skin of what was going on in China much better than any other. The really shocking thing was how much better these guys did than professional scientists who didn't want to touch the topic, professional spies who, you know, I had a conversation quite early on with a spook who, you know, in very confidential, you know, da, da, da. And then he told me something that not only had I read, I'd written.
That's great.
You know, so my respect for the espionage community rather went down during all this.
Yeah.
And a lot of politicians didn't want to touch it. We eventually accumulated an enormous avalanche of evidence that there was only one place and one time in the world where scientists were planning to put this one kind of feature into one species of virus that turned up in that place at that time.
Yeah.
You know, that the coincidence of place and time and of what they had been planning to do was truly gobsmacking. That persuaded the public,
yeah,
but it didn't persuade the scientific establishment. Mm. To this day, Science magazine, Nature magazine, they still say, oh, no, no, it's a disputed thing, and it probably didn't.
So you are way. You're now 100% convinced that it was
never 100%, but 95. Yeah.
And that's up from when you started writing the book. What would you have put it at?
Well, less than 50.
Yeah.
Wow. I thought it was less likely than not.
Do you, this is kind of adjacent to that, you know, and it becomes very difficult to have conversations about COVID, partly because Donald Trump with Operation Warp Speed really, you know, sped up the development of vaccines, but then kind of disowned that. And that's partly, it might be because he didn't win the election in 2020. Do you have any credible sources to believe that the rollout of the vaccines were slowed down for political reasons rather than kind of clunky procedural?
Not in my country. Britain was the first country to get the vaccines out there and was quite proud of it at the time. And that was largely the work of a friend of mine, Kate Bingham, who was put in charge of the vaccine program by Boris Johnson, and she went into the Department of Health and found it completely dysfunctional. And she tore a strip off everyone and brought in people to change it and made a huge difference and made Warp Speed happen in the UK. So, but we were only a few months ahead of the US. So I would think cock-up rather than conspiracy is more likely. There is a, in terms of vaccine timing, there is a strange fact, which is there was a man in charge of producing vaccines in China who produced his first vaccine extraordinarily soon after the outbreak happened. And we think it's very likely that he'd been working on it before they admitted the outbreak had happened, because they'd had an accident, they wanted to get on top of it or something. He died by falling off the roof of a building.
Mm, as one does.
A few months later. This is the kind of thing that, you know, 20 million people plus have died in this pandemic. That's the biggest industrial accident in history by about 1,000-fold. Bhopal, 25,000 people died. That's probably the biggest previous industrial accident. We can't let the water close over this episode. We can't say to China, oh, don't worry, we want to have a good relationship with you over trade. We need, as humanity, we need an accounting for what happened. And I just think it's really important. Mm.
So that's a good way to move towards talking about your apparent turn or possible turn from rational optimist to rational pessimist. As in a conversation we had some months ago, you said that that's kind of the code word of the book that you're working on now, The Rational Pessimist.
That was off the record, Nick. Okay. You weren't
anymore, you know. But in the Rational Optimist, you talk about how human progress is driven by exchange and specialization. And as long as societies are open to trade and innovation and the mixing of ideas, you talked about ideas having sex, and this is where progress comes from, living standards will continue to rise. Are you worried about that in, you know, when we live in a world where China is doing what it's doing and the West seems to be closing in on itself, or now, I guess, as you were suggesting, the Western scientific community is saying like, oh, you know what, China, don't worry about it. Just let that lie. But are is the very engine of progress kind of being shut down?
I am worried. Not yet to the point where I'm an actual rational pessimist. And by the way, I don't think I will use that title for the book. It's just a sort of working title for the hypothesis. There's a lot happening in the world that, well, put it this way, I had breakfast this morning with Jonathan Haidt, and I came away ready to slit my wrists. He's convinced that we're doomed as a civilization and in pretty short order. And he made a fairly convincing case. There's an awful lot going wrong. There's an awful lot of possibilities of things that could go wrong. But there's an awful lot going right, too. And I spent last week in San Francisco and Austin and was gobsmacked by how, and by the way, I'm traveling with fellow rational optimists, Steve McBride and Dan Steinhardt, who've done a wonderful job of introducing me to extraordinary people who are doing amazing things, not just with apps and electrons, but with bits and real things, digging tunnels, building prosthetic arms, supersonic engines, you know, nuclear power plants, etc. I think there's something extraordinary happening in America again now. Elon Musk is a big part of that. So is AI a big part of that. So I think there's every chance we are about to see a spectacular flourishing in technology. But you could have that flourishing alongside a social collapse, a turning in on itself, an autocratic moment where China becomes the most powerful regime in the world. I see a loss of faith in democracy. You know, maybe an awful lot of people are saying maybe we're better off with a non-democratic system. Certainly most Chinese people think that. And there's more of them than there are of you, and they're about to be richer, or as rich as you guys. I can imagine a world in which, just like happened 1,000 years ago in China, where the Song Dynasty had seen an enormous flowering of technology and science and culture and prosperity. And then there was a Mongol invasion followed by a centralized Ming Empire that just shut down everything and drove China back into poverty. That could happen to the world.
Yeah.
And as Stuart Brand said to me on Saturday, we have no backup this time. Right. You know, that time at least there was Europe who was going to pick up the slack. But on the other hand, the fact that we have a global enlightenment, a global flourishing, I think is more robust. And I think it's based on a much deeper improvement in living standards and much deeper technologies, particularly energy technologies. And I think, you know, if America were to completely lose its mojo and China were to fossilize into an autocracy, my bet would be on India to pick up the slack and start. And I said this in Jaipur earlier this year. I said, look, the job of innovative nation might be coming vacant. You guys should apply. But they've got a lot of problems.
Do you think Europe broadly is a lost cause?
That's what you all think over here. And you're not entirely wrong. I mean, you know, Elon Musk can land a rocket on a gantry. We can insist that bottle caps don't detach from plastic bottles.
I didn't realize that's a regulation. I was surprised.
It's a European regulation, which in Britain we follow because we still follow European regulations because we haven't taken the, you know, well, because you know, the bottle makers don't want to change for one country. You know, the degree to which we have stifled innovation in Europe is spectacular.
And the
first thing we do when someone invents AI is say, in Europe, we're going to be the leaders in regulating AI.
Are you bullish on AI? Is there anything about AI that frightens you?
Oh, there's lots that frightens me, but I'm bullish. I'm on the whole not frightened by the idea that it's going to turn malevolent, because I think that's based on a misunderstanding of evolutionary biology. Namely, you know, viruses are constantly turning malevolent, but they don't. One doesn't win. You know, there's always competing ones that do. And if an AI turns malevolent, there's no reason why another AI might not become very powerful at disabling the malevolent AI, if you see what I mean. So I'm not too worried about that. But I think the dislocation from lots of people losing their jobs could have significant social effects. I think the impact on how we run society in a world where there are agents more intelligent than us will undoubtedly have downsides, but it will also have upsides. No. And I don't think I know what those are going to be better than anybody else. Or I don't think anybody knows, if you see what I mean.
If you could deregulate one part of social activity or the economy, what would it be to, you know, help ideas have more sex than they're having right now? There's a sexual recession, right, with ideas, I suppose.
just to take a few things that the Trump administration has already done, they've nixed the thing that said you can't test supersonic, or you can't fly supersonic planes over land. That's going to be very helpful. They've said to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is an organization that has presided over novel nuclear designs for exactly 50 years, during which time it has approved zero new designs. They've said, we're going to do an end run around you. We're going to invite 10 firms to build plants, and we're going to allow three of them to go critical by July the 4th, 2026. The DOE is in charge of that, not the NRC. Yeah. Now, if one of those melts down and blows up, it's going to be in Idaho, I think, isn't it? And you know, it'll probably put egg on their face. But it doesn't look like that's going to happen. Yeah. It's resulted in a bunch of extremely safe, extremely sensible, extremely promising technologies coming forward. And there's a gold rush of them, and most of them are going to go extinct.
How much of that, I mean, you are a scientist or a science writer. You work in the media as much as anything else. How much of this is we need to be telling better stories about progress? Just thinking about nuclear energy. I mean, a lot of what you're talking about is we need more energy. Fukushima, when that melted down, more people died being evacuated than were ever implicated in any kind of problem from nuclear energy. You know, but very few people know that story. And we're in America, we're still talking about Three Mile Island, which released the equivalent radioactivity of, like, you know, a few dental exams, really. How can the media work to accurately portray progress, warts and all?
It's been a problem all my life. And the good news is that there's nothing new about it. I remember growing up in the 70s when the population explosion was unstoppable, famine was inevitable, pollution was going to shorten my life, cancer was going to get me when I was 35, my sperm counts were going to collapse, et cetera, et cetera. The grown-ups told me nothing positive about the future that I recall. Literally nothing. So the role of people like me is to go around saying they were bullshitting that. Oh, God, I've used that word again. Yeah. They were telling lies then, and they're probably telling lies now.
But you're the old person now.
I'm the grown-up in the room.
I'm telling you lies now.
I think, you know, Johan Norberg, Steve Pinker, me, Hans Rosling, if he was still alive, you know, have a role in poking the pessimists and pointing out when they're wrong. It's always going to be more newsworthy to give bad news than good. People are more interested in it. Bjorn Lomborg points out that, you know, you could say 160,000 people were lifted out of poverty yesterday, and that would be true for yesterday, and it'd be true for the day before, and the true for the day before that, but it's never going to make a headline, is it? And yet it's a much more significant headline than 10 people killed in a plane crash or whatever it might be. So good news is no news. We just have to fight that. And I don't know of any better way than to expose the data and get it out there.
Yeah. Matt Ridley, thank you very much for talking to us.